headlines. Afghanistan's president says he is in urgent talks with local leaders and international partners as Taliban militants push closer to the capital, Kabul. Lebanon's central bank governor says the bank is ready to use its mandatory reserves to finance fuel imports if the necessary legislation is passed. And at least 44 people have died in flash floods in Turkey's northern Black Sea region. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani says a remobilization of armed forces is the government's top priority as Taliban pushed towards the capital, Kabul. Ghani said fast consultations are underway to find a political solution to the conflict. He also pledged to fight the Taliban offensive and prevent further destruction and fatalities in the country. His comments came after the militants took over the provincial capital of Lugar-Pul-e-Alam, which is just 70 kilometers away from the capital, Kabul. Kabul is the last stand for government forces. The group is now in control of 19 provincial capitals across the country. The U.S. and a host of European countries have deployed thousands of troops to help evacuate their diplomats and nationals from Afghanistan.
And I expect that by the end of the weekend, the bulk of the 3,000 that we talked about yesterday will be in place. Probably not all, but the bulk. What we want to be able to do is to get there fast and get there capable and be able to provide as much capacity to the State Department as we can. And our intention is to be able to move thousands per day.
The Pentagon said its forces will be ready to airlift American nationals from Kabul if needed. The UK government also said a military operation is launched to help evacuate British nationals, urging them to leave the country immediately. Next, hashtag trending brings you the people's reactions on social media on Afghanistan's war against Taliban militants.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. We have another Afghanistan special for you today. Cities are falling to the hands of Taliban like the leaves of a willow tree on a stormy day. And there's little being done to prevent them from overrunning the country. Stay with me. The world is watching in abject horror as Taliban militants continue their advances towards the capital, Kabul. It might be too early to tell, but Afghanistan's neighbors might want to consider Afghanistan an Islamic state now from previously a republic. But fret not, people, because Americans are deploying 3,000 soldiers there. No, not to protect the people against the invasion, of course. They're just there to safeguard their own interests until they evacuate the embassy staffers. I am by no means suggesting that this war is for the Americans to fight. Quite the contrary. The Afghans should have always been in charge of their own affairs since day one, be it an armed invasion by the Taliban. But let's not forget who really is responsible for the current mess. The same people who invaded Afghanistan 2 decades ago to defeat these same Taliban militants. Now let's read some comments. The first one by Polaris reads, 36 days ago, President Biden told the American people that the Taliban would not take over Afghanistan after he ordered the removal of U.S. troops. Check it out.
Is a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan now inevitable?
No, it is not. Because you have the Afghan troops at 300,000, well-equipped as any army in the world, and an air force, against something like 75,000 Taliban. It is not inevitable.
Okay, on to the next comment by Christine, very much relevant to the previous one. She wrote, just like he told us he would unite, destroy COVID, not increase taxes, not cancel the pipeline, etc., etc., etc. Ashley wrote, 20 years, trillions of dollars and lives lost in Afghanistan for this result. The next one by Kamusime reads, the presence of the U.S. Army on Afghan soil was superfluous. After 20 years, they still could not train a competent army for national defense. If the Taliban win, that country will be dragged back to prehistoric times. Either the American leaders are hopelessly wrong with their assessment of the situation, or they are secretly gaining from the ensued chaos. Either way, Americans are fleeing Afghanistan, but have made sure to destroy all sensitive documents that could have potentially held them accountable for their decades of crime. Our next batch of comments start with one by PP on Press TV's website. He wrote, "The U.S. narrative of war changed overnight, protecting U.S. personnel and destroying everything and running away. What happened to bringing women's rights, human rights, freedom, and democracy?" The next one by Tola reads, "Same as what happened in Vietnam, when the dirty Zio-Nazi Western Israeli puppet regimes were toppled. The Taliban should have raided the offices of the U.S. and got all the paperwork before shredding it." The next one by Syrian reads, "In 2014, when American troops pulled out of Iraq, ISIS was born. With all the U.S. equipment, you can seize. Take a guess what's really happening in Afghanistan." The next one by DC reads, "Where do the Taliban get their arms from? Who provides for them their arms? Saudi Arabia, the U.S. military in the region, or maybe both of them? Wherever you are in the world, don't let the American army train your army. They can't. I mean, just look at Afghanistan." Our final batch of comments for the day starts with one by Zuher. She wrote, "One has to wonder as to what the NATO has been doing there for the last 20 years. If this is how they have trained the Afghan army, then the Allies should take lessons. NATO is only there to steal your resources." The next one with a photo attached to it is a tweet by Milena. She wrote, "Dear Afghanistan, on behalf of the world, I am sorry. Look at his sad face. Can you see all his sadness in his eyes?" The final comment for the day comes from Krishika. She wrote, "Now the concern is too much. People are worried about their future. The international community should act as soon as possible. Otherwise, a humanitarian crisis will break out in Afghanistan. Then it will be too late." And that's going to be it for me in this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Moving on, the Lebanese president has expressed hope that a consensus will be reached soon on the formation of a new government. Michel Aoun said a white smoke will soon appear regarding the matter. He blamed Lebanon's current difficulties on wrong financial policies. The country has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. That is when a huge blast devastated Beirut's port, prompting Diab to step down. Last month, Najib Mikati was tasked with forming a new government following the former prime minister Saad Hariri's failure to craft a cabinet. Lebanon is grappling with a deep financial crisis worsened by the ongoing political deadlock. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Lebanon's central bank governor says a bank is ready to tap into the country's mandatory reserves to keep subsidizing fuel. Riyad Salami, however, insists that this can only be done if relevant legislation is passed by Parliament. On Wednesday, the bank announced the decision to stop providing subsidies for fuel imports, saying that it does not have the constitutional permission to continue the scheme. That drew sharp criticism from the government. Beirut insists that the subsidy scheme must continue and fuel prices remain the same. Concern over soaring prices has sent people to fill up their cars in a panic. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and also Mohammed Faour, economist and a member of the Lebanese Party Citizens in a State out of Dublin. Now, thank you very much to both of you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Mariam. If you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this whole issue. On the one hand, we have the governor of the central bank claiming that he does not have the legal authority to tap into the reserves that he needs. On the other hand, we have the government that is insisting that he should. So who's right and who's wrong? Is legislation needed or not?
Well, there is definitely a very huge debate here in Lebanon. It's a controversial issue right now on whether there needs to be subsidies that continue or that subsidies should be lifted. There is agreement generally that they want to lift the subsidies in order to fund the citizens directly, especially those who are under the poverty line. However, they did not agree that these subsidies, especially on the fuel, should end now. And that was considered a unilateral decision made by head of the central bank, Riyad Salemi, and this is why this caused a lot of anger, not only among the people, but also among the political leaders themselves. Many are even economic analysts or political analysts are stressing that this proves the extent of power that Salemi has in the economic policies of the country, and the fact that he can do something that great and take such a decision, which is very decisive in this country, especially at this juncture of time when Lebanon is in a huge economic crisis and the need for fuel is very high and the shortage is also very obvious right now. So this is why this caused a lot of anger among the political leaders. They're calling on him to stop this. We're even seeing a lot of accusations against Riyad Salemi, saying that his economic policies have led to this issue. We're hearing this especially from President Michel Aoun, the group that also supports in the Free Patriotic Movement. We saw refusals, we heard refusals from many of the parliamentary blocs, especially Hezbollah's bloc, that stressed that there needs to be continuous subsidies given, especially to fuel, because as you know, we are in an electricity crisis, and that is, of course, exacerbating. That is on one hand. You also have the issues related to corruption, because one of the main conditions for the next cabinet is that there has to be forensic auditing, and that would probably target Riyad Salemi, who also has lawsuits filed against him, not only in Lebanon, but also in Switzerland and France and other countries. So some are saying that this is probably one of his ways to use a scapegoat in order not to reach a state where we have a cabinet and that can be used against him.
So, Mr. Faur from Dublin, if you could please elaborate more on the legal aspects of this. Does the governor of the central bank actually need some kind of legal authority or a change in the laws in order to tap into the reserves that he needs to continue those subsidies?
Okay, I think the problem is not really a legal one. It's more of a political one. The governor of the central bank did reduce, at some point a couple of weeks ago, did reduce the mandatory reserve requirement from 15% to 14% in order to free up around $1 billion to finance imports. That's not the problem. And it's problematic to reduce this problem to whether or not to subsidize. We've been living through a deep financial crisis for over 2 years, close to 2 years now. This financial crisis has not been the result of bad policies. It has been the result of policy inaction, of doing absolutely nothing to tackle this crisis, other than attempting to buy time and buy time and buy time. And this debate on whether to subsidize or not, and this subsidy policy in general, is only in the context of buying time until the inevitable happens, because at the end of the day, the resources are limited. Allegedly, $14 billion of mandatory reserves are left. Even that is not credibly verified, but let's take it on face value and assume that it is $14 billion. These reserves are ever so dwindling as time passes by, and awaiting for what exactly? For absolutely nothing. There is no financial plan. There is no economic vision whatsoever. We've been living in a vacuum a governmental vacuum for over a year. Not that the previous government was able to do anything. Clearly, they were not capable of doing anything aside from proposing a certain financial plan that did not pass through the parliament. So the key issue here is policy inaction, and subsidies are only existing in as far as facilitating policy inaction.
So exactly, if you could make that clear, why are they buying time? What are they waiting for? What do they want to happen?
I don't think they're waiting for anything in particular other than some kind of foreign deal. This is not the problem here. The problem is that the magnitude of the losses that we have accumulated over the last 2 years, at least, are gargantuan. They need to be distributed, these losses. There's for close to 30 years, we've been trying to just buy time and buy time and buy time rather than tackling the structural issues in Lebanon, albeit be it institutional issues or financial stroke economic issues. So the magnitude of the losses have been estimated to be around $80 billion relative to an economy which is now worth $18 billion. So this is gargantuan. This is a gargantuan loss that needs to be distributed. We know that any loss allocation exercise is a politically difficult and unpopular exercise, especially when losses are so large. And this political system and this political class is structurally incapable of carrying out this very bitter and very difficult loss allocation exercise, because, as I said, it's a very unpopular exercise.
Thank you very much. Interesting point. Mohammed Faour, economist and member of the Lebanese Party Citizens Nesayt, and our very own correspondent in Beirut, Maram Saleh, joining us live. Thank you for your comments. Moving on, the death toll from the flash floods on Turkey's Black Sea coast has risen to 44. Authorities have declared Kastamonu the worst-hit province, so where 36 people have lost their lives. 8 others also died in Sinop and Bartin provinces. 8 people are also believed to be buried under the rubble. Torrential rain and subsequent flooding have forced some 1,700 residents in Turkey's Black Sea provinces to evacuate their homes. The floods have destroyed homes and bridges and left hundreds of villages without electricity. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has declared the flood-hit regions as disaster areas. The floods are among the worst the country has experienced to date. Now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that WikiLeaks whistleblower Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. We now present you an article written by Brett Wilkins, staff writer for Common Dreams website. Based in San Francisco, his work covers issues of social justice, human rights, and war and peace. The article is titled, "Further Blow to Press Freedoms as U.S. Wins Appeal in Effort to Extradite Julian Assange." Britain's High Court on Wednesday, 11th of August, handed the United States a win in its bid to extradite Julian Assange, press freedom and other human rights defenders renewed calls for the Biden administration to drop all charges against the WikiLeaks founder. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd on Wednesday, 11th of August, ruled that the U.S. government may expand its appeal for a lower court's rejection of the Trump administration's attempt to extradite Julian Assange. On 4th of January, Judge Vanessa Breitzer of the Westminster Magistrates Court warned that extradition would be oppressive by reasons of Assange's mental health, and that there was a substantial risk the WikiLeaks whistleblower would kill himself in a U.S. prison. Claire Dobbin, an attorney representing the U.S. government in the case, had countered that Julian Assange would be able to resist suicide in American custody. The United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by the neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd said Wednesday that the High Court would hear the full appeal on 27th and 28th of October this year. Julian Assange has been imprisoned in London's notorious Belmarsh prison for over 2 years now. Speaking outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London on Wednesday, 11th of August, the former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn told demonstrators that journalism is a very dangerous and risky profession when done properly, and that Julian Assange walks in the great tradition of great, fearless journalists. Jeremy Corbyn added, "We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom. Julian Assange, to me, walks in the great tradition of great, fearless journalists. We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom, and will be here as many times as it takes to continue making that call." Stella Morris, Julian Assange's wife, told protesters that the U.S. government is exploiting the inherently unfair extradition arrangements with this country in order to arbitrarily prolong his imprisonment. Amnesty International legal advisor Simon Crowther said outside of the courtroom that charges like those against Julian Assange should never be brought against journalists or publishers. Simon Crowther said, "What this allows the U.S. to do is to challenge journalists and editors when they publish things the U.S. does not want in the public domain, sometimes classified material, which is the lifeblood of investigative journalists when they're investigating things like war crimes and crimes against humanity that are perpetrated by states like the United States." Simon Crowther noted that this would have a very significant chilling effect if the U.S. were to win this case. Journalists would have to look over their shoulder and worry about their legal liability when they accept information from sources provided to them confidentially. While Amnesty International in a tweet on Wednesday, 11th of August, wrote, "Simon Crowther, Amnesty International's legal advisor, explains why the Julian Assange case matters so much for freedom of expression and human rights, and why Amnesty International are calling on the American and the British governments to drop the charges against Julian Assange." Amnesty International on Wednesday, 11th of August, joined Assange Defense, Freedom of the Press Foundation, the International Federation of Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and other advocacy groups that reiterated earlier calls for U.S. authorities to drop all charges against the jailed whistleblower. Niels Muesnieks, Amnesty's European director said in a statement, this attempt by the U.S. government to get the court to reverse its decision not to allow Julian Assange's extradition on the basis of new diplomatic assurances is a blatant legal sleight of hand. Niels Muesnick continued, this disingenuous appeal should be dismissed by the court, and President Biden should take the opportunity to drop these politically motivated charges which have put media freedom and freedom of expression in the dock. Niels Muesnick, Amnesty International's European director, added, President Barack Obama opened the investigation into Julian Assange. President Donald Trump brought charges against him. It is now time for President Biden to do the right thing and help end this farcical prosecution, which should never have been brought in the first place. Edward Snowden, a former computer intelligence consultant who leaked highly classified information from the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, in 2013 when he was an employee and subcontractor for the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, on 10th of August said, the world's foremost human rights organization, Amnesty International, has issued an extremely strong statement denouncing the Biden administration's political persecution of Julian Assange, which reignites tomorrow. Julian Assange is charged in the United States with violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified U.S. military documents on WikiLeaks over a decade ago. Among the materials brought to light by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are the so-called collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army helicopter crew killing a group of innocent Iraqi civilians. The Afghan War Diary and the Iraq War Logs, all of which reveal U.S. and allied war crimes in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of the documents published by WikiLeaks were provided by former U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Unlike Manning, who spent 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama in January of 2017, none of the soldiers or commanders implicated in war crimes by WikiLeaks was seriously punished. Julian Assange could spend the rest of his life behind bars if he is convicted of all the charges against him.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, please accept our condolences. On these days of Muharram, which are the days of sorrow for the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. Now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A'adham Allahu ujurana wa ujurakum bi musabina bi Abi Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wa salam. May Allah give each and every one of us the greatest of rewards for commemorating the supreme sacrifice and for remembering the greatest tragedy to ever befall humanity. And that is the tragedy of Karbala, the tragedy which befell Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam and his family and friends on the 10th of Muharram in the year 61 after the Hijrah. I want to talk about a man in the next few moments as I conclude who truly got the maghfirah of Allah, subhanAllah. He truly attained the ridwan of Allah, the pleasure of Allah. He was a man that you and I know very well, a man named Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. Hur, the free man, as his name is, as his mother called him, Hur. Hur, as we know, was a commander in the forces that blocked Imam Hussein on the 3rd of Muharram when Abu Abdullah alayhi salam reached to this desert called Nainawa, or it was called Taf, or it was finally told it was called Karbala. Hur reached there with his thousands of soldiers on the same day as Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam. He blocked his way. He wouldn't let him move forward towards Kufa. He wouldn't let him change and turn back to Medina. He wouldn't let him take a step forward. The same Hur that we remember tonight was the same one who blocked Imam Hussein's way. But on that third day of Muharram, when Hur was ready to pray his salat, Imam Hussein asked him, "Do you want to lead or do you want to pray behind me?" And subhanAllah, Hur says, "No, you are the master. You are the grandson of Rasulullah. You lead the prayers and we will pray behind you." This is the same Abu Abdullah who gave the animals that were within the cavalry of Hur of the water, as he gave the soldiers of the army of, or the battalion of Hur of the water they needed to quench their thirst on the 3rd of Muharram. Brothers and sisters, the same Hur was the one who on the night of Ashura, when Abu Abdullah alayhi salam had dug a trench and had a trench dug around the camp, and they lit a fire around that trench to protect them on this night of Ashura. The cursed Umar ibn As'ad, Mal'un, he saw the fire being lit, and Hur was in the vicinity of Umar ibn As'ad, the cursed Umar ibn As'ad, and Umar yells out to Abu Abdullah that you light a fire today, are you preparing for yourself to go into the fire of hell? And Hur, hearing these words, probably thinking to himself that this is the son of the daughter of Rasulullah, how can he go into the fire of hell? What are we doing? Are we not destined for hell? Brothers and sisters, it was probably on that night that that spark of revolution continued to develop within the heart of Hur, this free man who on the day of Ashura, when Umar ibn As'ad again begins to plan the day of Ashura out, of what he's going to do, we know that on the day of Ashura, Abu Abdullah lets out a call asking if there's anybody there to help, if there's anybody there to answer his call. And Umar ibn As'ad is there, and the man Hur is there, and Hur turns to Umar ibn As'ad and he says, "Are you going to actually fight against this man? Are you going to attack this individual?" And Umar ibn As'ad says to Hur, he says, "The least of what I will do today, the least of what we will do this afternoon, is for hands to be severed and for heads to be cut off of the bodies. Yes, we will do all that we have to do to bring this man to submission." It was at this point, after Hur hears these words, my brothers and sisters, that he says to himself that I was wavering between two states of heaven and hell. On one side, there is hell if I follow my commander Umar ibn As'ad. On the other side is heaven if I follow Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. And he says, "By God, I swear that I would rather be burnt. I would have my body burnt. I would have my body burnt by the fire and make it to heaven rather than follow these individuals and make my way to hell." It's at this point that we're told that Hur begins to get ready. He mounts upon his horse. He has his spear in his hand pointed down to the ground with his head bowed in utter humility and humbleness and submission. He makes his way towards the camp of Abu Abdullah. He reaches to the camp of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He meets the Imam. He asks Abu Abdullah, he says, "Oh Imam," he says, "I am the one who have prevented you from moving forward. I'm the one who have got you into this situation right now. I'm feeling so bad. I hear the cries of the children." He says, "Is there any way for me to make tawbah? Is there any way for me to ask remorse?" Brothers and sisters, Abu Abdullah, the one who is the grandson of Rahmatul Alameen, he says to Hur, he says, "Oh Hur," he says, "if you turn back to Allah, then Allah will turn back to you. If you ask Allah for forgiveness for all that you have done, Allah will accept your forgiveness. Hur makes these words. He asks Abu Abdullah to forgive him. He asks Allah to forgive him. And on that day of Ashura, he begins first by asking Abu Abdullah for the permission to address the enemy troops. Abu Abdullah gives him the permission. He yells out to Umar ibn Sa'd. He yells out to Shimr. He yells out to his fellow people whom he was a part of in the army. He says that, will you stand there and deprive the son of the daughter of Rasulullah of a drop of water? He says the Jews and the Christians and the Zoroastrians are drinking from the same water of the Alkama. He says the dogs and the pigs are drinking from the water, but yet you won't give the son of the daughter of Rasulullah even a drop of water to drink. At this point, out of feeling the grief and remorse, he asks Abu Abdullah for the permission to go to the battlefield. Imam gives him the permission. He goes and he attacks his former friends, his former colleagues. Historians and books of Maqtal mention that Hur goes and kills many of the individuals. However, unfortunately, as it has been a long day for Hur, for many of the people involved in this tragedy, and the enemy forces are way too many in number, Hur is attacked. Hur falls off of his horse, and as Hur is laying on the ground, he lets out that last call to Abu Abdullah, Alaykum minnas salam, ya Abu Abdullah. Imam Hussein is able, with the energy that he has, to rush towards the battlefield. As the enemy people retreat, Imam Hussein goes to Hur. He puts his hand, he takes his head and he puts it in his lap. He wipes the blood from the face of Hur. He says to Hur, as Hur is leaving this world, he says, oh Hur. He says, oh Hur, you are just as your mother named you, Hur. You are a free man. You are free in this world and you are free in the world to come. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ
دَامُنَ الْمُهَرَّمِ Times of sadness have come. The crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala.
On the ninth it heard the prayers of those pure souls, fought the rising sun for, perhaps this could be its role. Akbar's azan so clear, this moon filled with fear, how will it possibly arise and see the state of those dear, and see the state of those dear?
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come. The crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The abduction of indigenous children was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. This is perhaps why the Israeli regime military targets children. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Benny Bland Ryder. This article is published under the heading, From Boarding Schools to Child Detention, Lives of Children Matter. Stay tuned for the details. Yes, I am thinking of Palestinian children and undocumented children as well, mused Dean activist Melissa Tesso. They are literally being killed daily by these settler governments. As an essential part of her culture, running helps to process things. And so she did the 2.15 run in memory of 215 indigenous children who were found in a mass grave at Kamloops Residential School in Canada. On May 29, 2021, Al Jazeera reported that the remains of more than 200 indigenous children, some as young as 3, had been found at the site of a former residential school in Western Province of British Columbia. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented deaths. The Columbus Toskumpe First Nation Chief Rosanne Casimir explained. They are among the many victims of mental and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence over a period of 100 years during which church-supported boarding schools operated across Canada. By forcibly taking children from their families, the schools sought to break Indigenous family and cultural ties in order to assimilate children into white Canadian society. According to Muskawis Voices, co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol, Calgary, and chairman of MIM Social Justice Committee, approximately 6,000 Native children died in residential schools from disease. Beatings, firing squads, malnutrition, and electrocution, among other forms of torture and neglect. The residential schools took the children from the land, Voices continues, adding, to disconnect people from their culture in order to take the land from children. Moreover, this form of genocide, he says, is ongoing as children are still removed from their ancestral lineages. One of the worst and most powerful things on this earth is the look in a mother's eyes and the pain she experiences when she has that which she loves most in this world taken away from her. Because the violence is ongoing, so is the trauma. Mental scars that are generational in nature, in that they are passed down from parents to children in a never-ending cycle of pain. Nevertheless, what happened to the children at Kamloops Residential School, writes Adel Skander, assistant professor of global communication at Simon Fraser University, is neither unique nor surprising. Like settler colonial projects everywhere, including the Americas and Palestine, its objectives, he continues, were always a combination of land appropriation, resource extraction, and demographic engineering. The abduction of indigenous children, he concludes, was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. Given this framework, it makes sense that the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinian children would be much the same. Indeed, in the past few days, the Zionist regime has launched a massive arrest campaign against Palestinians who participated in recent uprisings against the colonial project. As Abir Kopti notes, Zionist regime police officers, border police, and secret service members are expected to arrest approximately 500 participants in peaceful protests. Among those arrested have been children including Abdul Khaler and Mohammad Bornat, sons of Berlin activists by Ayad Bornat. In an interview with Robert Inlakish, Bornat chronicles the history of Israeli regime aggression that has for years been unleashed on his family. Earlier in May, Zionist forces murdered his nephew Islam, a 16-year-old boy who was participating in the protest. Since then, they have repeatedly invaded his house, along with other homes, wreaking havoc and arresting the children of other families. After they took Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad, my wife and my daughter don't sleep. The tears haven't left my wife's eye, said Iyad. My youngest son, Muhyiddin, he continues, Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad are now in Al-Mukbiya prison, a detention facility in West Al-Quds that, Inlakish says, has a reputation for using high-level forms of torture during interrogations. Indeed, Bernard reports that his lawyer, who communicated with Abdul Khaliq via computer screen, attests that the boy says he is being placed in what is known as a ghost chair for more than 15 hours a day in order to extract information that he does not have. According to Bernard, the ghost chair is small so that the hands and feet can be tightly tied to inflict a maximum amount of pain. These two boys are among the many children now in the Zionist regime jails. Palestinian journalist Zaina Halwani, recently arrested while covering protests in Sheikh Jarrah, documented her experience listening to Palestinian children screaming for their mothers during few nights that she spent in prison. In 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion warned, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." Indeed, he hoped that the old will die and the young will forget, ensuring that they would not return to their homes. This is perhaps why the Zionist regime military targets children like Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad. They want to begin breaking the resistance of the Palestinians when they are young in hopes that they will leave their land. It was also the rationale behind forcibly taking indigenous children away from their family in order to send them to the now infamous boarding schools, thereby severing their connection with the land. Fortunately, for the indigenous in the Americas and in Palestine, that strategy has failed. This resistance demonstrates the spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples and their land, a connection that native people believe the pipeline will sever. Given both these examples, it is clear that colonial efforts to ethnically clear the land has completely failed. As Melissa Tassot concludes, it shouldn't take the findings of our people's remains to validate this horrible legacy of colonial regimes. Respect our humanity by respecting the results, the truth in history, and by supporting our struggle for liberation. Stop treating us the same way our kids got mistreated in residential and boarding. Stand up for indigenous rights always. The same should be said for Palestinian children too. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein's Mubahala, sacrificing his dearest ones to rise up on the path of God. August 30th, 2020. This is a short part of a Dars-e-Kharij-e-Fiqh lecture delivered on the eve of Muharram on March 12th, 2002. Many people from among the respected elders, the narrators of hadith, prominent figures, respected people, wise men, caring and somewhat caring individuals, kept coming to Imam Hussein and saying, Sir, in doing this, you are engaging in a useless action, hurting yourself and the household of the Prophet, and humiliating the people of truth. They were saying such things. From the beginning, when Imam Hussein was planning on leaving Makkah, and some people found out about this, these various ethical obstacles began to emerge in front of Imam Hussein. This continued up until the night before Ashura. It is very difficult to have patience in the face of such events. In the same speech that I mentioned, I said that Imam Khomeini, may God be pleased with him, waited in the same way, and his patience was similar.
Ana mazlum Hussein Ana mazlum
Ana latsham
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September 27th, 2017.
أنا لاتشان
أنا لاتشان
There were many who told Imam Khomeini, Sir, we are losing these young people. They are being killed in this way. The country is being ruined. During the revolutionary movement, some were telling him that he was causing the best young people to get killed. Being patient in the face of these clumsy sympathies is a great task, a very great task. It requires much strength. He waited. Patience is not just in the face of physical pressures and sufferings. Look at these pressures that are brought in the form of prudence and caution, where some say, "Sir, you are acting imprudently." To be patient in the face of these and not give up the path that is clear, which leads to growth. This is the great and beautiful patience that Imam Hussain had. And then his companions are killed one by one in that horrible situation.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.